We'll start off here. Welcome to Narkees, September 22nd, 2018. And we are continuing with the triennial parasha. I think everyone here knows that, what we're doing. If not, feel free to ask. We are in Numbers 25, verse 10, to Numbers 26, 51.
So I'm just going to write that.
It's the trail of Balaam, and what we're going to call Baal Peor. That's the name of this story in its memory throughout the Bible. And this chunk of Torah scripture is going to be paired with Malachi 2:5. So our main course is Numbers 25. The dessert is Malachi 2:5. And following. And we're going to try to learn what we learn from these selections, especially in light of each other. I think that you'll find the Malachi, or I found the Malachi section, the dessert, more interesting than the main course in this case, simply because it has more direct relevance. We have a large chunk of genealogies. However, I am a purist, so we are going to read them. So here we go. If you can read, let's see, where are we? Numbers 25, verse 10. If you remember, we just had the incident. Who was here last week? Gemma? Yes, we had a very significant incident that was almost like an icon of what not to do. We had a leader of the tribes of Israel commit not just sexual immorality, but idolatry, Cozbi and Zimri. In fact, we're actually going to get the remnants of it. So just in a big painting, if you were to paint this, what happened? You see Israel settle down in the valley of Moab. And this is after Balak and Bilam tried to go up to every high point and curse them. It didn't work. And then what would you paint? What happened next?
They went off to the gods of Peor.
How did that happen? How did Israel just happen to go off to the gods of Peor?
Harlotry. I mean, why did it happen?
How did it happen? Through what?
Leaders and Bilam.
Well, Bilam apparently gave some advice, but what was the advice? I can't curse these people, but how do you get at them?
They invited the people to sacrifice to their gods.
Right, they invited women. Yeah. Women. They sent women, they're setting up a sacrifice to their gods, and the women are going to invite them in, and they're going to somehow then join the sacrifices of their gods. And that's going to be able to break this covenant of protection that God has with his people. So that's what's just happened. What happened also as a result of all of this going on?
Well, it ends up with an Israelite having sex with a Moabite woman.
Okay, that was going on. Well, not just one. I think many.
But
one significant person with one significant Midianite.
And then Pinchas.
Pinchas, what did he do?
He basically sticks a knife into both of them.
Right. And who is Pinchas?
Pinchas is the grandson of Eleazar, the high priest.
Well, there you go. He's a priest. And what else was happening during this whole time?
There was a plague.
A plague, exactly. A very large plague that's running rampant through the camp, and people are dying. So that's also important to keep in your mind. Okay, so now Pinchas does this iconic deed, and the plague stops. So that's where we're going to start reading. Gemma, if you'd start for us, basically we'll read through this selection a chunk at a time. If you'd prefer not to read, just tell the person next to you.
So 25:10.
25:10, right? Yes.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel, because he was zealous with my zeal among them, so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. Therefore, say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and his descendants after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the children of Israel. Now the name of the Israelite who was killed with the Midianite woman, was Zimri, the son of Salu, the leader of a father's house among the Simeonites. And the name of the Midianite woman who was killed was Cosbi, the daughter of Zur. He was the head of the people of a father's house in Midian. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, harass the Midianites and attack them, for they harass you with their schemes, by which they seduced you in the matter of Peor and in the matter of Cosbi, the daughter of the leader of Midian. Their sister was killed in the day of the plague because of Peor.
After the plague, Adonai sent to Moshe and Eleazar, the son of Aharon the Kohen, take a census of the entire assembly of the people of Israel, 20 years old and over, by their ancestral clans, all who are subject to military service in Israel. Moshe and Eleazar the Kohen spoke with them on the plains of Moab, by the Jordan, across from Jericho, exclaiming, those 20 years old and over who came out of the land of Egypt, as Adonai ordered Moshe and the people of Israel. The census results begin with Reuben, the firstborn of Israel. The descendants of Reuben were of Hanok, the family of Hanoki, of Palu, the family of Palu, of Hetzron, the family of the Hetzroni, and of Carmi, the family of the Carmi. These were the families of the Levi. Of them were counted 43,730.
The son of Palu was Eliab, and the sons of Eliab were Nemuel, Dathan, Abiram. The same Dathan and Abiram were the community officials who rebelled against Moses and Aaron, and were among Korah's followers when they rebelled against the Lord. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed them along with Korah, whose followers died when the fire devoured the 250 men, and they served as a warning sign. The line of Korah, however, did not die out.
Who's reading next?
These were the families of the Shimoni, the 22,200 sons of God, according to their family. For the north of the family of the Northmen, for Hagi from the family of Hagi, and Leshemi, the family of Shimi, and for the Shimi, from the family of the Shimi, from Ozni, family of Ozni, to Ari, family of Ari, Arod, family of the, is that?
Arod.
Arodi.
Arodi, uh-huh.
And Erieli, from the family of the Erieli. These are the families of God to their appointments, 40,500.
Okay, I skip. You may not.
Oh, okay. Ur and Onan were sons of Judah, but they died in Canaan. The descendants of Judah by their clans were through Sheba, the Shemanite clan, through Perez, the Perezite clan, through Zerah, the Zerah clan, the descendants.
the Shimmerite clan. These are the clans of Issachar. Those numbered were 64,300.
The sons of Zebulun, according to their families, were of Sered, the family of the Sardites, of Elon, the family of the Elonites, of Jalil, the family of the Jalilites. These are the families of the Zebulites, according to those who were numbered of them, 60,500. The sons of Joseph, according to their families, by Manasseh and Ephraim, were the sons of Manasseh, of Michah, Machir, the family of the Machirites, and Machir begot Gilead, of Gilead, the family of the Gileadites. These are the sons of Gilead, of Jezer, the family of the Jezerites, of Helek, the family of the Helekites, of Azrael, the family of the Azraelites, of Shechem, the family of the Shechemites, of Shemidah, the family of the Shemidites, of Hefer, the family of the Heferites. Now Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, had no sons, but daughters, and the names of the daughters of Zelophehad were Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, Ter, and Tirzah. These are the families of Manasseh, and those who were numbered of them were 52,700.
These are the descendants of Ephraim by their families, of Shutalak, the family of the Shutalki, of Beker, the family of the Bakri, and of Tachon, the family of the Tachoni. These are the descendants of Shutalak, of Iran, the family of the Irani. These were the families of the descendants of Ephraim, according to those of them that were counted, 32,500. These were the descendants of Yosef by their families. The descendants of Binyamin by their families were of Bela, the family of the Bali, of Ashbel, the family of the Ashbeli, of Akhilam, the family of the Rakhilami, of Shufan, the family of the Shufami, and of Hufan, the family of the Hufami. The sons
the
of Bela were Av and Naaman, of Av, the family of the Avi, and of Naaman, the family of the Naami. These were the descendants of Binyamin by their families. Of them were counted 45,600.
These were the descendants of Dan by their clans through Shuham, the Shuhamite clan. These were the clans of Dan, all of them were Shuhamite clans, and those numbered were 64,400. The descendants of Asher by their clans were through Imnah, the Imnite clan, through Ishbi, the Ishbite clan, through Beriah, the Beraite clan, and through the descendants of Beriah, through Heba, the Heberite clan, through Malkiel, the Malkielite clan. Asher had a daughter named Sarah. These were the clans of Asher. Those numbered were 53,400.
All right. Well, let's move on. Verse 48, Jerry.
Descendants of Naphtali were, by their clans, were through Jaziel, the Jazeelite clan, through Guni, the Gunite clan, through Jiza, the Jizorite clan, through Shilem, the Shilemite clan. These were the clans of Naphtali. Those numbers were 45,400. The total number of the men of Israel was 601,730.
By these numbers. Okay, what am I putting up? When was the last time we took an account of the numbers of Israel?
So your first list on the left would be the first time.
The first one. And if anybody uses the Net Bible, they'll give it to you in a footnote.
Menashe.
He started at
32,200. So,
the reason I'm putting them both up, okay, why would they count people right now?
They took a census.
Why are they taking a census?
Because they're going into the land and they got to divide the land up.
Oh, the plague killed the people.
There you go.
The plague, they've lost a ton of people.
And so they're taking an account of who they've lost. And so that's why I'm writing up these numbers, because it's going to be interesting Who is lost?
Who's lost and who's gained?
Manasseh.
What do you notice about these numbers?
Some would go up.
Some have gone up.
And some have gone down.
And some have gone down. That's, yeah, that's an interesting thing to me.
Mostly gone down, right? Mostly have gone down. But 20,000 more added to Manasseh. Where did they come from?
40,500. Or did they not die in the plague?
Two.
Okay, Ephraim is to 32,500. Let me just finish it off, see if we got to the end. And I need to get to Binyamin. Okay.
Two,
three. They were 35,400.
Four.
35,400. And now they are 45,600. Except in the Septuagint on this one, they are actually 35,500.
Oh, there's only nine names up there.
What happened?
You have more there?
There's more coming. Okay, so Dan was 62,700. And now it is
64,400.
64,400. Great. That's Dan. Asher was 41,500. What is it now?
53,400.
Okay, good. Who's next? Naphtali was 53,400. What is it now?
45,400.
What did you say? 45,400. Okay. And then we just have the total.
601. 700.
Does that say 700? Oh, 730.
Okay, and before it was?
It was 603, 550. So, the interesting thing is a lot has happened in between here, right? What are the big things that have happened to the people since the first count? Korach, and not just Korach, Datan, Aviram. So there were leaders of the community. There was certain clans that were swallowed by the earth. And now there's been a big plague. And yet, all in all, what do we have?
It's a loss of 2,000.
The overall numbers aren't that significant.
But there is one major.
But internally to the tribes, there are some significance.
One huge.
Which is huge?
Shimon.
Yeah. That went hugely down. I'll do like the stock market. How about we do everything that went down? Okay, so
this
five went down.
Okay, this went down. Is that significant or not?
No, it's like.
Would you call that significant? 5,000?
No, probably just maybe more than 10%, I'd say.
What's so significant is
Judah's a big up, and Ephraim's a big down.
Yeah.
Manasseh's a big up.
Naphtali, what would you say?
That's significant.
That's over 10%.
So if we're going to mark the significant people who lost here, we have Shimon, Ephraim, and Naphtali.
But Menasheh is a big up.
Yeah, it's a big up.
Yeah, so I should have another color or something.
You need a green marker.
I should. I know, to be the stock market.
What's the time scale? How many years between the two?
That's a good question.
Less than 40.
Oh. Okay. Our big ups.
But if you really want to just point out what's the biggest, that's, I think, the most significant.
Binyamin.
Yes, Benjamin also.
Well, Asher also.
So. But the biggest is like over Menasher or Shimon. I mean.
Okay, so of particular interest, Joseph's sons are Menasher and Ephraim. Yeah, Ephraim is going down here, and Menashe is going up.
A big up.
A big up. And Ephraim took a big down.
But Shimon sends out. Shimon got the biggest down.
Shimon got the biggest down. It went from 59,300 to 22,200. Naphtali took a down, and Ephraim took a down in a serious way. Some others were whatever. So why are we noticing these things? Because they're written there. Beit Peor, this place of Peor, goes down in the national memory as a serious sin, a big traumatic event. And there were several of them. And it's interesting to me that the one we often remember is the golden calf, right? There they also had a plague, and they were also punished. There were also consequences. And yet a lot of people don't talk about Baal Peor. But it's up there in the national conscience with the golden calf, I would say.
Right, because last week we read in Judges where it said they still mentioned Baal Peor.
Yes, in Joshua, I think you're talking about. In Joshua 22, verse 17, it says, "The sin we committed at Peor was bad enough. To this very day, we have not purified ourselves. It even brought a plague on the community of the Lord." It's actually, my translation was stating it as a statement. It was actually a rhetorical question. Was the sin of Peor too insignificant for us? Implying, no, it was not.
Is it because the golden calf affects the whole lot? We don't have numbers saying that one tribe sinned more than another, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, we've got specific
leaders.
We have leaders.
Well, we don't know, do we? Because these numbers are actually totals at the end of whatever.
Right.
So we don't
actually
know, you're right.
So you can read between the lines. If the plague was on the people who sinned, and that represents the difference in numbers, then apparently most sinners were in certain tribes. It could be read that way, yes.
Yeah.
And
it's
that's
significant that Judah is not.
Yeah.
Judah becomes such a sort of a line of righteousness, if you like.
Who are we missing up there?
Levi.
That's interesting.
And the Levites are not counted. The Levites don't inherit the land. And this goes on next week.
They're not counted in terms of land. They are counted because the service of the Lord is also similar. You count from age 20 and up. Because you're entering kind of like the Lord's army, so to speak. And yet they don't appear in this.
But is it because the next week we go straight, this land should be divided as an inheritance according to the number of land. So it's this list is like it's specific for land.
Whereas yeah, you could say that. You could also say that, who is Pinhas?
He's a Levite.
And particular family of the Levites. But so our parasha starts with a covenant to him, to Pinchas.
It's also to do with the army, because it's the 20th and over, it's military service.
Military service and also temple service are both counted from age 20 and up. There's that similarity. So, look back in the parasha in Numbers 25:10. First, we get this Pinhas, son of Eliezer, son of Aaron the priest. He gets a special covenant for all his descendants. And we're going to be looking at that covenant. And who did he kill?
He killed
a Shimoni, right? A Simeonite, a leader of the clan. Zimri, son of Salu. In Numbers 25, verse 14, it mentions the names, and it seems that he didn't just go out and kill any random person who was engaging in this idolatry. He killed a leader of a clan from Simeon. And who was he with? He was a daughter of a leader. So if you're in the ancient world, what's going on here if you're reading between the lines? You have a leader doing something with the daughter of another leader.
It's kind of like a royal marriage.
It's kind of like a covenant. Yeah. So it seems like they're actually going through some type of rite that would connect them covenantally with this people. A political alliance, and it involves their gods. And so this is pretty bad stuff. It's not just a random act of fornication. And I think when you line up all the numbers, it's very clear who was hit hardest was Shimon, and their leader was the one killed. So if you're reading between the lines, it looks like they were somehow instigators or somehow very involved in making this whole thing happen.
So I'm just going to highlight them.
And up until that point, they were the third largest?
Yeah, I mean, they were very large before, yeah.
Only Dan and
Dan,
Judah.
Zebulun is similar, but under. Yeah, so you have Judah, Dan, and then Shimon. And then they get knocked to one of the smallest.
It's interesting that Joseph threw Shimon in prison in Egypt.
Yeah, when you start to think about these fathers and who their descendants were and what happened to them, again, when you're reading in David's time, you're very aware of the history and who these people represent. And when you read these stories, you're thinking, oh yeah. So that's what happened, kind of thing.
So what did this, where does Shimon fit in with the Joseph story, particularly?
He kept him back. He threw him in prison.
Yeah.
Well, they all did, but why do we pick on Shimon?
Because of birth order. Reuben is firstborn.
Reuben tries to sort of quasi rescue him.
Yeah.
Well, you have to read it.
Yeah.
It doesn't
say. He's just one of them. Right, okay. That's what I just thought because you mentioned it. It seems sort of more
similar. See, back to the Egypt incident, wasn't it Reuben that offered his two sons to the father, saying, I'll give you in place of. Who was kept there at Sinai? The one that ended up in prison was Shimon. Shimon, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right.
In place of Reuben or Judah, Judah said, Dad, I'll give you my life if I don't bring back. If you let me take Benjamin, I'll give you my life. The word is my life. And Reuben offered his two sons to his father.
Right.
And there were reasons why Reuben, Shimon, there are reasons throughout the stories why they are demoted, basically, from firstborn status through their actions. Interesting, Levi has some bad stuff and some good stuff. I'm thinking about in Abraham's days, Chamor, Dina, you know, the whole Dina incident.
Yeah.
Who goes out and avenges Dina?
It's...
It was
Shimon
and Levi, and they were kind of very vicious.
Just for some of us that were not here last week, that Do you remember? Did you discuss it?
We did discuss it.
Minimally. Either it's part of the rite or it's people crying because people are dying?
Yeah, it's whether the day refers to the people of Israel around the tent crying because of the sin and the judgment, or whether it's the two people that went in there and they were crying or moaning or something. And
we did read Psalm 106:28. That talks about this event briefly. It says they worship Baal of Peor and ate sacrifices offered to the dead. Zivhei metin. Vayochlu zivhei metin. So what was going on in this ritual exactly, we don't have direct details.
It's a good question, isn't it? Because why were they weeping? Were they weeping because they actually felt guilty? Or were they weeping because people had died? Or were they weeping
because it was part of a ritual to the dead?
Part of the ritual to the dead? Or were they weeping because they couldn't get the women that they wanted? I mean, who knows?
Or was the dead here a metaphor, like sacrifices to something that can't save you?
But the they isn't necessarily clear either. The they could be the Israelite man and the Midianite woman.
Right.
Has just said you've got to put to death those in your tribe who've joined themselves to Baal Peor. So the following verse talking about weeping, to me it just suggests help, they're weeping at this judgment.
And joining yourself also to be yoked with, it literally says in verse 3 of Numbers 25. And again, when I look at this.
And again in verse 5.
Yeah.
To kill the men who were. I've got joined, but you've
got
yoked. Yoked about.
So Sharon, it's implying that the people who are really the sinners in these groups, these tribes, they're the ones that God struck with the plague.
Yes.
It isn't a random giving of life.
Yes.
I mean, there's a reason why God had certain ones die, right?
Yes.
It's only implied, but it's not stated really pretty.
Yeah. Yeah, it is that strange, the crying, who's crying and why are they crying? It's kind of stated there as nice background, and somehow we're supposed to understand. But this concept of being yoked to a foreign god, this is doubly bad, because golden calf was really bad, right? But what was the sin of the golden calf? What was the context? Well,
trying to appeal to God, but through
Moses is gone, right? And so Aaron's like, we need something. We were all prepared to do this big covenant. We need something. So let's throw together something. We'll come up with this cow. And here are the gods that brought you out of Egypt. But he's still connecting it to Adonai. So it's wrong. And yet it's still something that they're kind of just offering as a substitute. There's no foreign Baal coming in. But at Baal Peor, they're adopting the religion of the land. Like Baal worship is the predominant worship in Canaan. And every city, you know, you have these focal points. So you have a Baal of this city, Baal of that. But, so you're making a covenant with a foreign god, essentially.
And also you've got the whole issue of the sexual act, which you don't have, I think, with
well, as we mentioned, Baal. No, well, you can read it into the golden calf.
Okay.
Yeah.
They got up to play. Letzachek.
Yes,
and playing is what Isaac and Rebekah did,
yes,
that showed Avimelech that they were husband and wife.
Yeah. It wasn't football.
Yeah, it wasn't football. So, yeah, so apparently there was some type of revelry going on, but it wasn't necessarily, like here, there's sexual stuff going on, but it's in the context of a sacrificial rite. And we know that Baal is what? He's the god of rain. Well, floods too, but rain is what guarantees what?
Fertility,
fertility, crops. And so to make a deal with Baal is to guarantee security, right? You're coming into new land. Oh, this is the god of this land. Let's make a little covenant. And so there are many reasons why this is a huge deal. Yeah. Yeah, so you could say golden calf is syncretism, where you still have Adonai, and you're mixing in practices of other people. But Baal Peor is beyond that. Adonai is not even in the picture. You're like blatantly going to Baal. So
they have found inscriptions from that era in the desert of what looks like images of Adonai.
Asherato, yeah, Kuntelet Ajerud.
God, so it looks like it's saying Adonai and his Asherah.
Which is like Baal has an Asherah. In many pantheons, there are more than one god, and there's a male god and a female god, you know, and so Adonai and his Asherah. They've transcribed the concept. Hosea.
So, whereas you would call the golden calf syncretism, which I really like, is there a one word, we just go back to paganism or some such?
Which one are you discussing?
For Baal Peor.
Baal Peor is not even syncretistic.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
It's blatant idolatry.
Okay, idolatry, that's what I want.
And idolatry, by nature, because of the beliefs of Canaan, is fertility rites.
Right, okay.
And so the metaphor becomes reality as well. To guarantee fertility, you go sleep with a concubine at the temple.
Right.
Like, that is part of the idolatry.
Right.
So the two are very much connected.
I was just looking for the one word, idolatry, and I couldn't get it.
Okay, so Hosea, we are going to get to our Malachi verse, because that's what we were sent to by ancient eyes. But I'm going to throw in Hosea 9:10. And it says, when I found Israel, it was like finding grapes in the wilderness. I viewed your ancestors like early fig on a fig tree in its first season. So what is that picture? Fruit. There's a sense of, you know, like, oh, wow, you're in a deserted area, and here are grapes, and how wonderful is that? Or like the first fig trees, like this promise of luscious wonderfulness.
That's
Hosea 9, verse 10.
Oh, right. And but
they came to Baal Peor, and they dedicated themselves to shame.
I've got separated themselves.
This is the word vayinazru. They were... It's like what a Nazirite vow does. You can do it to the Lord, and here they did it to Baal. They separated themselves. It doesn't actually say Baal's name. What does it say instead? Boshet, shame. Because to even mention his name is bad. We have this in many people's names. Mephi Boshet, his original name probably was Mephi Baal. Ish Boshet would be Ish Baal. So anywhere that there's a word Baal to like stamp it out, you put shame. And it's a nice little replacement because it shares the first letter, B. Boshet Baal. And they dedicated themselves to shame, which is Baal. Then it says, they became as detestable as what they loved. Vayihiyu shikutsim ke ahavam. Ahovam. So as good as they were in the beginning, like Hosea paints this picture of like this initial purity and wonderfulness, as good as they were in the beginning, they became equally detestable by what they did. So Hosea, this prophet in the north, he remembers this event in the wilderness, and he reminds the people of what happened. And he's going to equate that, because what is Hosea's big metaphor for Israel, for the northern kingdom?
It's the whole story of faithfulness.
Yeah, but what is the metaphor? What does he say over and over and over to the people? Anyone remember?
Who?
Hosea.
What metaphor?
What is his... He just keeps saying... The bride? Okay, the wife. Who is the wife? Israel. Who's the husband?
God.
Right. And God keeps telling Israel, know me. Yeah. When Adam knew Eve, what happened? They had a child. So God is telling Israel, know me. It's a very powerful message. Know me. Like, and it works well because in the fertility rites, there's sexual involvement that guarantees fertility. And it's like saying, instead of that whole thing with Baal, which is not right, I want that kind of relationship with you, but not obviously in a physical sense, in a spiritual sense. I want you to know me so intimately. And so there's this sharp contrast between what the other nations are doing and what obviously the people of Israel did as well to knowing the Lord. And it's very poignant. But back to our...
It's something how that isn't drawn attention to because it sounds so shocking.
It does sound shocking.
It's like we've gotten over the shock that God would refer to his relationship with his people as being that of a prostitute. That's shocking enough. But
yeah. Or an unfaithful wife, depending.
Yeah. But again, that's also...
That is shocking.
There's also connotations of sexual relations there too, but somehow we've gotten over it because there it's we're the wayward one, and so you kind of put all of the awkwardness on ourselves.
Yeah.
But here, God is one asking for a relationship.
Yeah.
In a positive way. It can be positive. So like every time we refer to sexual relations, it's always in a negative sense. And so you can kind of just keep heaping this negativity on that thing. But
and partly because other nations literally practice some type of ritual.
Right.
Where in God's rituals, you never have any type of sexual practice as solidifying the relationship with God.
So
it's purely a metaphor.
And in our sense, we always think, okay, it's to do away with sex.
Completely.
That's the only positive way that we can think of it.
Right. But actually, he's retaining the metaphor
because
it's powerful.
And say no.
Yeah.
It's interesting that as believers, we so to speak, purify it or, I don't know, whatever we do with it. In common speech, if you say to, somebody says to somebody, do you know someone?
Yeah.
The answer is, well, yes, but not in a biblical sense.
Right.
So everybody knows, in terms of language, just what that means.
Right.
Yeah.
But somehow, as believers, we somehow...
Well, we have a hard time talking about sex in a positive...
Well, also, the translation comes in here, because not every language carries the same double meanings.
Yeah.
To know the Lord carries that double meaning. There's a tension there. In English, we have acknowledge the Lord.
Yes.
You know, husbands don't acknowledge their wives. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not the same thing.
Really bad,
so. You know, it's just the act of translating forces you to lose the punch of the metaphor. You know, it forces you. And then our own bias, we would like to kind of clean it, lest someone get the wrong idea kind of thing. But it also loses the power of God. His actual ultimate desire is for intimacy beyond what the people are imagining at the moment. You know, they're imagining, well, you know, isn't this enough? And he's like, no, actually, I want a deeper relationship with you. And I love that because a lot of times Christians, we have this dichotomy of there's the Old Testament God and all of a sudden he got saved and became a New Testament God, you know? And I'm like, okay, if God is unchangeable and his heart has always been grace and compassion and and a desire for relationship with us. Doesn't he have to have that same character in the Hebrew Bible as well? And so, to me, Hosea shows that. And this is thousands of years, or not that, over 1,000 years before Jesus' time. And you see right there in Hosea, he does. That's always been the goal.
To them, I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek and I bent down to feed them.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful intimacy.
Yeah. Hosea 11? Yeah, Hosea mixes several metaphors. His dominant metaphor is the marriage one, but he does have the father and
the father
child.
I taught your friend to walk.
Yeah, yeah.
Taking them by their arms.
Okay, so now we need to get to the Malachi before we're out of time. If you look at Malachi chapter 2, verse 10 is where we start. Verse 5. But it's interesting because we start in the positive stuff. But right before, he was actually getting a little angry at the priests. He says, if you do not listen and take... I'm reading from verse 1. If you do not listen and take seriously the need to honor my name, says the Lord who rules over all, I will send judgment on you and turn your blessings into curses. Indeed, I've already done so because you are not taking it to heart. You're not paying attention. I'm about to discipline your children and will spread offal on your faces. What is offal?
Feces.
Dung from inside animals. And the very offal produced at your festivals. And you will be carried away along with it. Then you will know that I sent this commandment to you, so that my covenant may continue to be with Levi, says the Lord who rules over all. Net. I mean, offal is consistent with how they translate perish in the Levitical sacrificial laws. You know, when you sacrifice an animal, parts of it are unclean, and you take it outside the camp and burn it, including the insides of the intestine. Which is, we have many names for in English. One name that is more palatable is dung.
Offal, palatable.
Yeah, maybe that's not the word to use. Offal makes it even...
Offal makes it cleans it up because some people eat offal.
Oh, yeah. Well, some people eat the intestines when they've been cleansed of the offal, but they don't eat the offal itself.
I thought the offal was the word for a pancreas and a whatever.
No, no. Offal is poop.
Okay.
Oh, the excrement in the intestines that's partially digested. Yeah.
Okay.
So God's going to spread offal on your faces. Sounds a little bit different. It stinks. And it's impure, makes you impure. So it's not really what you're looking forward to. Okay, so now in verse 5, Gemma, why don't you read for us in verse 5?
My covenant was with him, one of life and peace, and I gave them to him that he might fear me. So he feared me and was reverent before my name. The law of truth was in his mouth, and injustice was not found on his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity and turned many away from iniquity. For the lips of a priest should keep knowledge, and people should seek the law from his mouth. For he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But you've departed from the way. You've caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore I've also made you contemptible and base before all the people, because you've not kept my ways, but have shown partiality in the Lord. We go on?
Sure, we need to go on. There is some stuff to discuss here, but go ahead.
Have we not all one Father? Has not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously with one another by profaning the covenant of the fathers? Judah has dealt treacherously, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the Lord's holy institution which he loved. He has married the daughter of a foreign god. May the Lord cut off from the tents of Jacob the man who does this thing, being awake and aware, yet who brings an offering to the Lord of hosts. And this is the second thing you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping and crying, so he does not regard the offering anymore, nor receive it with goodwill from your hands. Yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. But did he not make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit? And why one? He seeks godly offspring. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth.
So it's very interesting here how the metaphor becomes practical as well. Did you see that switch? So it's not just that Judah is profaning God. Okay, so that's the same metaphor as Hosea has. But somehow, they're also cheating on their wives, quite literally. And if you want to put those two things together, you can imagine what happened with the Midianites. The very act of going after other gods involved sexual acts with other women, right? So you could literally be doing both things at once. You could be basically cheating on your wife by sleeping with other women in the attempt to guarantee fertility. Now, I'm not saying that that is the only thing, you know, could just be they're cheating on their wives anyway. I don't know. But it could be, in light of the passage we read before, that part of their idolatry was, in fact, physically being fornicating with other women.
But the interesting thing, Sharon, is that the next verse, which I didn't read for some reason, the Lord of God, God of Israel, says that he hates divorce, for it covers one's garment with violence, as the Lord of hosts. Therefore, take heed to your spirit. So what you're saying is that this harlotry with the fertility goddesses or whatever, temple prostitutes or whatever they are, is like marriage.
Yeah.
And therefore, if you and the Lord hates divorce, so you have to separate, you have to, don't get involved.
Right.
It's not just easy saying, okay, I'm going to.
The other interesting thing actually is what.
Because this verse is often taken out of context by people, genuine people who really want to get divorced.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the Lord hates divorce.
Yeah.
But somehow in this context, it's linked.
It seems to be linked, yes. In the context, it seems to be linked. You could see the link several ways. One, this direct one about, you know, idolatry. And then the other, just that by being idolatrous to God, it also creates a... we cheat on each other. Like, how we treat each other is how we're treating God. So in that sense, it says, you know, why do you cheat on each other? That's how it started out. And so it could be just a very practical thing, like this is what I see going on with you, and it reminds me of your relationship with me. Or it could be directly, like I see you committing these sexual acts with pagans, basically. But did you notice you cover the altar of the Lord with tears? And we were talking about who was crying. And so this is another thing, like if we knew more about some of the pagan rites, rituals, certain things might have new meaning for us. And I don't know, I can't say with any clarity, but it would be interesting if these tears were part of a ritual act that is reminiscent of what the Midianites were doing.
But the biggest link is the first verse.
Yeah. And but to follow that thought I just said, in verse 13, because they're, you know, weeping or whatever, God doesn't pay attention to the offering. So whatever this weeping is somehow disqualifying their offering. So to me, that smacks of they're doing something not kosher here. And so maybe they're copying from other people what their rituals were.
Would we say crocodile tears?
Well, that's the other interpretation, is that they're pretending to be repentant and they're not really. So one is you're just being hypocritical, and the other is you're actually borrowing a ritual that I don't like, and therefore it's defiling your offering because I gave you specific commandments for the way I want you to worship me, and it's not like the other people.
The question about this,
Yeah.
Did you know that? That's
the wording?
Yeah, because that's forbidden. It says in 11 and 12 to marry a woman from one of us.
Ah, right, right. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the big thing. So if Judah is desecrating the holy things of God or the holiness of God, the question is, how is he doing this? And so Malachi is, of course, living in the temple. What's actually going on? What is Judah doing? And then there's this curious, I don't know how you translate it. It says, Judah has desecrated the holiness of God, which he loved. And he husbanded the daughter of a foreign god. So to me, you have the same contrast. Instead of knowing the Lord, you are cheating on God and going after a foreign god.
The parallel verbs there, ahed and uva.
Uva'al.
Is interesting because they're both, in a sense, love verbs in this point.
Yeah.
And you had asked earlier whether the translation he could refer to Judah, the holiness of the Lord, whom he loved. In other words, Judah had already pledged himself
to the Lord,
to be a lover, meaning faithful covenanter with the Lord, and yet he took in marriage the other God. And that does make good sense. And so the question arises, if that made sense, how and why do all of European translations go a different direction? And I see it here now in the Septuagint, because the Septuagint uses a plural referent. It says, which things he loved, as opposed to whom he loved.
So if you guys are following what Randall's saying, in verse 11, I'll read you from the NET translation. For Judah has profaned the holy things that the Lord loves. So God loves these holy things, and Judah comes and profanes them and then goes off with the other god. The other way to understand it is Judah's profaned the holy things
of the Lord
whom Judah used to love. So Judah originally loved the Lord, and now he's going out and marrying someone else. And so it seems in the metaphor that Judah was the one originally who loved the Lord, and now he's gone after someone else. But the Septuagint, who are the translators into Greek, they read this and they translated holy things that the Lord loves is referring to those holy things. So the Lord loves his holy things, and now Judah's come and profane them.
That's and, what I've got. Yeah. I've got Judah has profaned the Lord's.
So your translation is being influenced by the Greek translation. That's right. I would say in the Hebrew you have Judah doing the action of profaning. And then he's also doing the action of taking on another wife. And so then there's this little clause that he loved in the middle. And the question is, who's the he? Is it God or is it Judah? And I would say in the metaphor it looks like it's Judah. Verse 11.
Right.
Yeah, well, it's slightly ambiguous. There's no, it doesn't say Asher Ahev Yehuda. It just says Asher Ahev. So is that he referring to Judah, or is that he referring to God? What were you going to comment on?
Well, the main connection is in verse 5. Right?
Yeah.
The
main connection with the two stories is verse 5, that you have a brit shalom, you have a covenant of peace, ironically offered to Pinchas after he's just killed a bunch of people, and you have an emphasis on a certain characteristic. What was that?
That he might fear me.
Yeah, he fears God. What does he not do? What does he not consider? I guess we haven't freshly read the passage. When Pinchas went out and started killing people, he didn't take into account if they were his own family or not. He was killing anyone who who was hooking up with Baal Peor.
I thought he only put the knife into that one couple significantly.
Well, and that's the significant one we hear about.
Right.
But
and he becomes, and he's known as zealous for the Lord, and he gets this covenant of peace. I don't see a lot negative about him.
No, you're right. But there was also a command said, go out and kill anyone who is hooking up with Baal Peor, and don't pay attention if they are your family members or not. Like, and so Pinhas has this covenant because he was just going to do the right thing before God, regardless of family connections.
And one last thing, the context which we've been reading in chapter 2 of Malachi, it seems it has a lot of connections, right, to the passage of Pinhas.
Yeah.
Another thing is, in Malachi 2:2, it says, I'm going to turn your blessings into curses.
Yeah.
It sounds like the opposite of what Bilam did, you know?
Uh-huh. Like, I can change those blessings into curses based on if you're going to follow the covenant or not. So, yeah, so there's a lot of nice connections between these passages. The context of idolatry, going after foreign gods, which involves some of these sexual rites. And so some of these powerful metaphors.
Marriage.
Infidelity, and comparing that to Israel and the relationship to God. And then this whole thing of like how you act before God and what you're willing to do is determines really whether you walk in God's blessing. So even though there is this covenant that's permanent and there are these promises and blessings, they can be reversed based on how you act. So I always like that kind of juxtaposition, because it's all built on a foundation of grace. Like, this is God's covenant, but he's still watching what you do, whether you're going to walk in the covenant or not. And that will have an impact on things. So I see we're out of time. Does anyone have any final thought on this selection?
The walk in the covenant is to offer true instruction. See, the priests didn't do all that.
Right.
There was false things in their mouth.
Yeah. And the same word, to have a covenant of peace, is what originally in our Numbers passage, he was rewarded. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So speaking the truth and peace go together.
Yeah.
And when we see unrest, we have to look where the untruth is.
And there's, when you don't keep my commands in verse 9, you don't keep my way, and you, it says, venosim panim batorah.
I've got shown partiality.
You show partiality in your instruction. And so then the question is, you know, what does that really mean? What were they doing? What's going on there? To laset panim can have several different meanings. But yeah, in this context, you know, to show partiality. And what does that mean? Like you're giving some instruction and not giving others that you know should be given? Or does it mean like, usually showing partiality involves people, right? Are you somehow honoring some people and not others?
And the result is that many are stumbling here.
Yeah, many are not doing the right thing. Because you're not telling them the right thing to do. Or you're saying what they're doing is okay. Maybe they're paying you off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they're giving you sacrifices that aren't worthy of being sacrifices, and you're looking the other way because they're your family. Mm-hmm. Like, there's all kinds of ways you can be corrupted.
And that's true in just real life. Right?
It is, absolutely.
We like to believe in, or such and such a thing, it's not loving. You know, I can't tell so-and-so that they're really making a mess of things. It's not loving, whereas mm-hmm. in fact the truth might be a real blessing. And whether it's mm-hmm. on an individual level or whether it's on a national or a political level, we have to learn to speak the truth and walk in truth.
Yeah. And I do like the connection over here that was made of peace and truth going together.
Yeah,
because you're not bringing truth to provoke someone or to put them down.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
It's to actually bring peace.
And you won't get peace unless you have truth.
Yeah.
If you have all this, you know, we have peace processes, and let's make peace and whatever, but you're actually not speaking the truth into the situation or not acknowledging the reality of the situation.
Randall West gave a wonderful teaching on Ephesians 6, where it says, girded with the belt of truth,
right,
and how everything hinges on truth.
Right.
If you don't want truth, it was in connection to spiritual warfare,
right,
that to love truth is at the heart of how we fight against the devil.
Right.
If we don't embrace the full truth, like you say, the challenge is how to walk out the truth without criticizing or, you know, to do it the wrong way.
Right.
Speaking the truth, the love is true. But if you don't have truth, you will stumble.
Right.
And one last thought. In Paul's whole talk about, you know, don't be unevenly yoked, for what does the spirit have to do with demons and all that, I think he draws a lot of his imagery from Baal Peor and Malachi.
Right.
Even here you have this connection, well, being yoked to Baal Peor, it uses that specific word several times. And then here in verse Malachi 2:15, no one who has even a small portion of the spirit in him does this. And what was the verse before? You become unfaithful to your wife. And so it's interesting. I think Paul's argumentation is using language that's reminiscent of these passages. So that's just something else to think of as we think of applying it. But we're out of time, so Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.